From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll look at the state's gun laws and learn what's going to be allowed during the Republican National Convention. Then we'll get some local chefs' perspectives on the most recent season of Top Chef filmed in Wisconsin.
Maybe it changed a couple people's minds on what the state's like. I think people still watch the show, and when they turned it off, they're like, oh yeah, all they eat is brats, cheese, and all they drink is beer. They could have done a better job, I think, showing more of what's offered here in Wisconsin.
Plus, we'll share some state park recommendations, including our very first to be founded, Interstate Park.
We started talking about the Wisconsin State Park system really early on. In 1878, the Wisconsin legislature approved the protection of what was then called the State Park, one of the first of its kind in the country.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Today, three of Wisconsin's top chefs will give their thoughts on this latest season and how it depicted Wisconsin and our food staples. Hear that group chat later in the show. We'll start with this. The Republican National Convention is estimated to bring about 50,000 people to Milwaukee in just a couple of weeks. Among the delegates, RNC staff, law enforcement, and others in attendance, protesters have plans to march at the convention each day. With so many people coming from out of town and large crowds expected, we've been hearing concerns from Milwaukeeans about safety, particularly when it comes to Wisconsin weapon laws. WUWM's Eddie Morales speaks with local attorney Tony Cotton to break down the details of the state's laws and explain why attempts to regulate weapons during the event have failed.
Can you explain what are Wisconsin's weapons laws?
Wisconsin, of course, is a CCW state. That's a big thing. That means that people can apply for a concealed carry permit. Once they get that permit, they can possess a weapon in a concealed way. So if you have a CCW permit, you can, considering firearms, for example, you can conceal your gun and carry it wherever you want, subject to, of course, restrictions that certain businesses may have on whether or not they permit firearms in their facility. Wisconsin's also an open carry state. So you could choose not to be a CCW holder and just have your assault rifle slung over the front of your chest and walk down the road.
How do those laws apply to people from out of state?
There's not an in-state, out-of-state distinction. Well, the CCW thing, obviously you'd have to, if you're an out-of-state resident, apply for a CCW permit. But the open carry laws apply equally to every citizen who's not a prohibited person from possessing firearms. There's a whole category of people who can't possess firearms because they have a felony conviction or they have a domestic violence crime involving violence. Those people can't possess guns. And there's all sorts of other prohibited categories. But out-of-state people, if they are not a felon and not prohibited, they can carry a gun in the open or they can get a CCW permit and conceal their gun.
Looking ahead to the RNC in mid-July, there will be a hard perimeter that the Secret Service will oversee where weapons won't be allowed. But outside of that security zone, will there be any restrictions on open or concealed carrying?
There are not, and there can't be restrictions in general on open carry. It's clear that you have the right to possess firearms if you're not a prohibited person. But again, can there be narrow exceptions such as government buildings having some restrictions on that and private businesses? Yes. But outside of that hard perimeter zone, you could very well see people choosing to open carry or possess guns in the open. One thing that just comes to mind in my mind is when we had some of the BLM protests, for example, that were happening. So this is the left side of the spectrum, arguably. I was involved in a lot in some of these groups and helping provide legal advice. There were numerous people just walking down the road with assault rifles slung right over the front of their chest. And the police can't and won't do a thing about it.
In your experience, what are some concerns that people have, just questions that they ask, or after already experiencing some of these situations and encountering them, what are some of the concerns that they share?
Well, I'm a criminal defense attorney. So usually when people are reaching out to me, they have a concern about their own situation. So it's very personal and very unique. I get a lot of phone calls these days from people who have not felony convictions, but old domestic violence convictions, maybe disorderly conduct or battery, something that happened 25 years ago with a roommate or 15 years ago with an ex-girlfriend. And I get calls every day, multiple calls a week and virtually every day from people who want to know, can they possess a firearm? The other things I hear from people, obviously, I'm just a member of the community. I hear about people who are expressed concern about some of the relaxed firearm laws in Wisconsin. But that's for the policymakers to work on, and obviously not my role as a defense attorney.
Some city officials have supported temporary weapon regulations during the RNC, but the Common Council ultimately voted against implementing that. Can you explain how a temporary gun ban conflicts with state law?
Yeah, well, I think it just conflicts with the Constitution is the problem. You have a right to keep and bear arms. And of course, the federal Constitution, the Second Amendment, has clearly been interpreted by this current Supreme Court and past iterations of the Supreme Court as absolutely conferring and providing a individual right to possess and bear firearms. And so any ordinance that would be passed to temporarily restrict that right would be struck down immediately in court.
Well, thank you again so much. I really appreciate the time.
All right. Nice seeing you, Eddie.
Tony Cotton is an attorney in Waukesha. He spoke with WUWM's Eddie Morales. We did this story based on responses to our election survey. You can help shape our coverage about the RNC by filling it out at WUWM.com. In light of this year's presidential election, many of us have been reflecting on the year that was 2020. In the latest episode of WUWM's new podcast, Swing State of the Union, hosts Joy Powers and Sam Woods explore what happened that year and how it impacted the 2020 presidential election.
Leading up to the 2016 election, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin hadn't voted for a Republican presidential candidate since the 1980s. All three were considered part of the Blue Wall, a collection of states that had consistently voted for Democratic presidential nominees in recent decades, and many assumed that would continue. Instead, all three voted for Republican Donald Trump in 2016, securing his win. In Wisconsin, 23 counties that voted for Democrat Barack Obama in 2012 flipped for Trump in 2016. And the state went for a Republican nominee for the first time since 1984. Democratic circles were searching for a reason why Wisconsin flipped for Trump. Some pointed to the fact that Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton didn't visit as a candidate.
Angela Lang founded Black Leaders Organizing for Communities, or BLOC, a year after the election. The organization is dedicated to improving the quality of life for Black Milwaukeeans through political advocacy and education. And she explains how BLOC was conceived during the fallout from the 2016 election.
I think a lot of folks, quite frankly, had a lot of hot takes about what happened. And one of those hot takes, someone said to my face, a white woman, she wagged her finger in my face and said, if you people would have just voted, we wouldn't be here. That's the wrong thing to say to me. but then also I was like, that is the wrong narrative. And if we don't get to the real issues, we're just doomed to repeat this in 2020.
Over the next few years, BLOC knocked doors for elections from governor to school board. But 2020 was going to be the big test, an opportunity for the organization to come full circle from its origin in the last presidential election cycle.
We knew it was going to be a big year. We were like, it's 2020. We knew the pressures of 2016. So we knew kind of that shadow of like, this is going to be an aggressive year. We had plans. We had all these doors we were going to knock. We had all of these plans of hiring all these people, including a field director.
Then the world shut down.
Good evening and thank you for joining us. We are going to begin right now with breaking news because the World Health Organization has declared the coronavirus outbreak a pandemic.
All of a sudden, people were asked to stay home. Businesses closed, workers were laid off en masse. And every day came news of new COVID-19 cases throughout the state. Everything was up in the air. When will I get to go to the grocery store again? Will I have a job next week? What might happen to me if I catch this virus? Oh, and also, there was an election coming up.
Less than 2 weeks after Governor Tony Evers issued a safer at home order asking Wisconsinites not to leave their homes unless absolutely necessary, the state's presidential primary was held. In Milwaukee, a city of nearly 600,000 people, only 5 voting locations were open due to a lack of poll workers. One of those locations was Lang's alma mater, where lines of voters zigzagged through the surrounding neighborhood.
It was heartbreaking, you know, to see the pictures of people standing in line. And I think we've all seen those viral photos, People were hand-making masks at the time.
Joe Biden would win the Wisconsin primary decisively, taking over 60% of the vote. A day later, Bernie Sanders, Biden's last remaining challenger, suspended his campaign, setting the stage for Biden to run against Donald Trump in the November election. And in that time, the COVID-19 pandemic was quickly politicized.
According to Pew Research polling, by late March, 83% of Republicans said Trump was doing an excellent or good job at handling the pandemic, compared to just 18% of Democrats. Trump, Vice President Mike Pence, and other Republican leaders regularly didn't wear masks, while Biden and top Democrats did. Trump downplayed the need for masking for months and criticized Biden for wearing one. In October, Trump and the First Lady both got COVID-19, and the then-president was hospitalized. Democratic officials decided the Democratic National Convention would take place virtually in an effort to mitigate spread of the virus. A scaled-down Republican National Convention would take place in person. And elections themselves were also changing drastically. Barry Burden, a professor of political science and director of the Elections Research Center at UW-Madison, explains how in Wisconsin and across the nation, municipalities were seeking outside funding to administer elections safely.
Election officials were scrambling for resources to try to pull off an election that they had never run before in this way. They were administering more mail ballots than ever before, a massive number of those. There were concerns about the Postal Service being able to meet delivery standards on time with such a rush and some cutbacks that were happening to the Postal Service. They were trying to figure out ways to keep poll workers and voters safe. And many poll workers had decided not to serve because they were concerned about their health. And it's an older core of people, typically in their 60s and 70s, who do that work. So they were scrambling for resources, getting poll workers from new places and applying for, in some cases, private funding to help pay for things. And that was true in Wisconsin, where several big cities got large grants, but also many municipalities around the state got private funding from nonprofits to pay for things like plexiglass shields to protect poll workers and voters, sanitary wipes, gel, drop boxes to collect paper ballots outdoors, all those kinds of things.
In addition, unprecedented numbers of voters were choosing to vote absentee, as we discussed in episode 4. For organizers like Angela Lang, this made it difficult to know what to expect on Election Day, even after months of scrambling to organize voters.
I think folks have a gut feeling of what's going to happen that day. I remember having a gut feeling in 2016 at about 3 o'clock, and I was like, yeah, I'm not going to go to the watch party. Like, I think there's a certain time of the day where you're like, okay, I think we got this, or we've been tracking numbers and turnout. And you couldn't really do that because everybody was voting by mail, and you couldn't really do a lot of like exit polling and get like a real, it was just all those traditional norms were very difficult. So I think for us, it was a lot of wait and see what happens.
That uncertainty remained throughout election night as absentee votes in Milwaukee were tallied late into the night. But when voters woke up in the morning, the absentee votes were counted and a tentative result was in.
Joe Biden is the apparent winner in Wisconsin. That would award him, if it does officially go to him, those 10 electoral votes.
In early December, after recounts confirmed Biden's win in Wisconsin and nationwide, Trump still maintained that he had won.
It was about fraud. This election was rigged. Everybody knows it.
In part because Wisconsin was so close, the Trump campaign was active in trying to overturn the state's election results. Molly Beck, a politics reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, who covered the aftermath of the 2020 election, explains the lengths the Trump campaign went to and how the Wisconsin Supreme Court narrowly sided against him.
After the election, Trump and people who support Trump filed a bunch of lawsuits over the election, and Trump himself paid for 2 recounts, one in Dane County and one in Milwaukee County, and in doing so, asked to throw out hundreds of thousands of absentee ballots in those liberal-leaning counties. And if that had been successful, that would have, you know, shifted the result of Wisconsin's election and potentially the national election. The Supreme Court played a key role because they got all of those challenges and had to decide, you know, if there was any merit to them. It was particularly notable because The court at the time was controlled by conservative justices, 4-3. And one of the conservative justices, Brian Hagedorn, sided with the liberal justices in rejecting these challenges.
But this didn't close the book on the 2020 election. And in some ways, the fight was just getting started. As Trump was giving speeches claiming the election was rigged, a group of Wisconsin Republicans were hatching a plan to officially certify the state's electoral college votes for Trump in a way that, like so much of 2020, was unprecedented. As we explained in episode 1, Wisconsin is prized in presidential elections because of its 10 electoral votes. But per the rules of the Electoral College, these votes aren't automatically given to the winner of the state. Technically, that's done by 10 individual people who sign paperwork certifying Wisconsin's results, which are then sent to the vice president to officially certify in the U.S. Senate. This process is necessary per the U.S. Constitution, but until 2020 had always functioned as a procedural formality.
But a group of 10 Wisconsin Republicans sought to turn this formality into a last-ditch effort to deliver Trump a victory in Wisconsin. The group sought to sign paperwork as the state's legitimate electors, certifying the election for Trump, along with groups in 6 other states planning to do the same. The plot is known as the Fake Elector Scheme.
Joy Powers and Sam Woods host WUWM's Swing State of the Union podcast. You can hear more about the Fake Elector Scheme and what happened in 2020 in the latest episode at WUWM.com or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also tune in tomorrow at noon right here on 89.7 WUWM. There will be a live taping of the final episode tonight in Milwaukee at No Studios. Tickets are still available, and you can find information at WUWM.com. In about 20 minutes, we'll highlight some of the best state parks Wisconsin has to offer. But first, 3 of Wisconsin's top chefs give their hot takes on this season of Top Chef. Keep listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. This season's Top Chef contestants put their knives down one final time last night. The season took place in Wisconsin and highlighted some of our world-famous cuisine and world-famous chefs, including Milwaukee's own Dan Jacobs. But how did the show do? We asked 3 of the state's top chefs that question in this month's edition of Group Chat. Here's James Beard nominees and Top Chef judges Luke Zahm and Greg Leone, joined by chef and state assembly representative Francesca Hong. We'll hear first from Zahm about his experience on Top Chef.
I mean, there's kind of like an associated headache always with doing things that are being run by national networks, like a lot of NDA work. And this NDA was particularly toothy.
Did you read it? Because I just signed it.
I paid somebody to read it.
Oh, yeah. I didn't read it. I just signed it. So I don't know. Maybe yeah, I owe them a kidney or something.
I had like this duality for the show because I had done some of the background work with parties or agencies in the state of Wisconsin to like try and just like, okay, if I'm spitballing, these are some of the people that we really, really need to talk to. You know, when we talk about like Wisconsin food, the current status of, you know, like our cheese, our beer, our sausage, all those things are great. But I tend to look at it with a longer perspective. And that for me always centers into the indigenous food movement. It's been part of this place's history longer than the cheese and the beer and the sausages.
And I thought the episode that highlighted Elena Terry, as you mentioned, Luke, about the, and you know, indigenous cuisine. I mean, we've got 11 tribes here in Wisconsin. And I think that was the episode where it's like we're really transcending beyond the Bratz beer cheese narrative and was so important. I think, though, we shouldn't be able to just have one episode like that, right? Like never was there a mention of the prominence of and the influence of Hmong farmers here in Wisconsin.
I was thinking about that this morning.
Yeah. And then I think there was like one contestant at the farmer's market who was like surprised by Asian-y ingredients at market. Mm-hmm. And like, it's like, no, we have the 3rd largest Hmong population in the country. And how much they've contributed to all of our markets and also like people like Dan Cornelius having Hmong farmers and indigenous farmers contribute to, you know, elder food boxes during the pandemic. Like we could have done, they could have done a much better job of going just beyond who is, I like the cranberry fields, but I would have liked to see some more Hmong farmers on the show.
I do feel like they did go for the low hanging fruit when they were trying to show what comes from Wisconsin. So it was like cranberries, beer, sausages, cheese curds.
Yeah, but where was the ginseng? Yeah. Where was the fact that we have, why couldn't they have gone to a wild rice field?
It was a very interesting perspective, like being there. So I really wanted to emphasize all those pieces. And then like when I get on the actual location set, I got to sit next to a gentleman who's a dear friend of mine, Charlie Behrens. He actually had no idea kind of what he was doing there. And I felt a little bit like a fish out of water. And then we were, you know, escorted down into the Miller Caves, and like they keep feeding the table beer. And I told the producers before I went on, like, yo, I'm sober. I've been sober for almost 5 years now. And it was their prerogative to keep the Miller High Life in front of me. And it goes back to that idea, like, you know, you're here to make television. And the optics of the television are more important than the personal optics that you sometimes hold as a human being.
I was thinking about how one of the biggest winners off of this show is actually High Life. I mean, right. out of all of the different sponsors, and maybe some folks would argue it's Whole Foods and BMW, but, and here I am uplifting High Life again, but I actually noticed it too, that so much of the taping, like of the chefs prior to Judgment and Verdict, was everybody around drinking. And I think, especially since 2020, there has been way more conversation around wellness in the industry. And to me, it was kind of disappointing that once again, we're really perpetuating that, like this notion of like go hard and then play hard, and everybody drink after your shift. It's definitely still going, but I think there's a lot more of us in the industry thinking very differently about how addiction is prevalent, and really brigade systems don't serve us anymore, and how can we get out of this cycle of go hard, play hard.
Totally.
I haven't watched Top Chef in a while, but there was way more storytelling, I think, of like individual of the contestants, right? Or maybe that was more this towards time? The end. Yeah, of like, I was surprised at how diverse the cast was.
Yes.
Compared to previous years. But I was also kind of nervous because sometimes when that happens, I thought a lot of the stories were actually about people's vulnerabilities and insecurities of wondering, like, should I really be here? And then you kind of take away from this like usual reality show frame of it's like Survivor, and yeah, there's always a villain, and there's always an antagonist, and there's always someone that you kind of want to root for.
There was no villain this time around, I don't Mm-mm. think. They were all actually very nice.
Yeah.
You kind of wanted all of them to win.
Yeah. Well, and then like my like fear is that like, okay, we don't have that in the cast. Is it going to be like lower viewership? And then people are going to go straight to, well, this is what happens when you, you know, focus on diversity and inclusion.
You know, I was part of the Facebook Top Chef Wisconsin, and I actually got kicked off and banned from the group because I would go on there every, you know, after the episode just to see what people were saying, and they were just trashing the show, and they were saying that it wasn't as exciting as before, that the people were boring, that there was no drama, and they were talking smack about Wisconsin. And I went on there one day, and I was like, why are you guys talking all this garbage about Wisconsin and the contestants? I'm like, I'd like to see some of you on there. Like, oh, we're not doing that. So I take screenshots and respond, and they didn't like it. And
here are the receipts, bro.
Here's your receipt. I'm like, you just said this yesterday. And so they banned me from it. That's the only cooking competition show that I watch because I feel like it doesn't have a lot of drama, and it's more about the food. You get to know the contestants and a little bit about their background. And like, you know, in episode two, I think when Dan's telling the rest of the cast that he has Kennedy's disease. Mm-hmm. But it's not, I think season two was the only season, that was the only season where they really focused on a lot of what happened in the house. It's when they tried to cut Marcel's hair. I've been watching it since season one. And it was a lot of like stupid fighting and drama. And I was like, I don't care about this. Like, I don't care that they don't get along. I just want to know what they're doing.
Small pivot here to, you know, in talking about not just diversity in workers, but most of the diners on the show were
white.
All white.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a pretty white show.
Especially the Madison. I was really disappointed in the Madison episode. Not of like, I have so much respect for Tori and the chefs that they figured. I was so happy to see Jamie Huang on the episodes as well. But like the Harvey House dining room, I don't know if I could have, like, I don't think I found a person of color or a black person there.
Restaurant Wars also, I looked pretty white from what I remember. Yeah.
And that's where you could have done a lot more to try to get folks out, because we already have an accessibility issue, especially like higher end restaurants and who's able to go, right?
Do you think it even crossed their mind? Is it something that they even think about?
To have diners of color?
Yeah.
Well, in a lot of those cases, you're working with the travel industry. And so it would have depended on who you were partnering with to get folks onto that show. And I don't know if those organizations really prioritize who is dining on the shows.
Probably not.
Hey, Fran,
yes?
I really want to, can I switch gears on a question that like
for
centers
sure.
into politics a little bit?
Yeah.
As an elected official in the state of Wisconsin, different agencies in Wisconsin put out a lot of money to bring Top Chef in to come here and film. I wonder, like, what are the ROIs, the return on investments? What would you see are the metrics for return on investment from having a production like Top Chef film in the state of Wisconsin?
Hard to quantify what the ROI would be from an investment like this. It's great to see communities come together and be really proud of Wisconsin. I think that's always an important, like, unifying issue. And it's one actually that when I go to different parts of the state, I really try to talk to people around being proud to be from Wisconsin. And I think it's one of those issues that kind of goes beyond economic or other cultural issues that are dividing us right now. But I think it's difficult, again, to quantify the ROI, especially when in a city like Madison, and I don't know if Milwaukee may be enduring this too, but we have more restaurants per capita than I think is sustainable. And so you're still going to see restaurants closing. Maybe you'll see folks coming to great cities like Milwaukee because they've seen it on Top Chef. But is it redefining Wisconsin as beyond beer, cheese, and brats?
Brats, beer, cheese, and brats.
Beer, cheese, and brats. I think so. I hear the hosts of the show talking about how Wisconsin is more than that. Did we need other people to be ambassadors for us? I'm not sure.
In talking about that specific issue, the ROI, like how do you measure success? I think it's so ill-defined, quite frankly,
right.
What
we
success
can't measure,
might
really.
Look like. Right. So, you know, if it's $1 million that's kicked out by, you know, state entities to bring them here, to set up lodging, to negotiate all this, what would you like to see, given what we know now about where they taped, where they were, outside of like, if we could go back in time and like bring them to some of our mid-sized cities like Wausau, Stevens Point, Eau Claire, you know, maybe even LA Cross.
Wait, who calls it LA Cross?
Like, what
the f***?
lots of us call it LA Cross.
LA Cross. When you're negotiating a show like this, and I'm asking you, look, because you know you live in that world, could a Wisconsin, or when I say Wisconsin, whoever was, you know, representing the state and the cities, say, okay, you can come and tape here, but we need you to do X amount of filming in these towns or small cities, and we want X amount of people of color or people of different ethnicities to be featured. Can you set those parameters for a TV show, or would they have been like, peace out, we're going to Minnesota?
Yeah, maybe. I'm not exactly sure on what parameters that can be set. You know, I think that the production company comes in with the idea of making a good television show.
Yeah.
Obviously, the state entities want to be brand ambassadors for the state of Wisconsin and really try and like pump up the industries that are here, that are, you know, thriving at the moment and maybe have thrived just a touch in the past. Fran, you touched on the ginseng industry and like, yeah, that is a huge, that's a huge sleeper industry in the state of Wisconsin. The majority of that is exported out, but like a lot of people don't really know what you utilize ginseng for.
I didn't know that it grew here in Wisconsin. I just learned that right now.
It's a massive industry. Yeah, it's one of our biggest exports. But You know, I think with tourism, a lot of their metrics is like how much money is coming into a city. We're not actually talking about who gets that money. And then again, like I think about how influencers go in, like the ones with bigger Instagram accounts to restaurants and cafes and bars. And it's like, we don't know what the ROI is on that, right? Like, we don't know who is coming in. They're not going to be out here being like, well, I saw this on this person's story, so I'm here. So I wonder if like it's just a bigger translation of that for the tourism industry. Again, I think culturally we are seeing a lot of people get really excited about their city and their state when you are on a national stage on a show like Top Chef. But in terms of ROI, like, are we going to be able to connect a restaurant opening or closing because of Top Chef? We don't know.
I think also that the amount of restaurants that will benefit from the show being here, it's very limited. Like, I don't think, at least in Milwaukee, I don't think every restaurant in Milwaukee is going to benefit from them being there.
I hope some of the, like the cheese industry and, like, folk, some of the smaller producers that were featured get to see an increase in their revenue. I mean, I will say, when Morris was still open, we had a couple of folks from the production team, like, stumble into the restaurant. And they, I'm very proud to say, were, you know, really excited that this was some of the best food that they'd had in Madison. But, they, you know, they had been given our name as a recommendation. Okay. And so those are, again, hard to quantify, like, how much of the production team was actually out here spending money in the cities that they filmed at. But, again, those folks aren't coming back.
So we had, the production team came in twice, the executive producers, to eat at Amelinda. And then we had a group of eliminated contestants come in and eat. But I don't think, I haven't heard, and I don't, the staff hasn't told me whether anybody's come in and said, oh my God, I saw him as a judge. That's why I came in. I mean, it was a super fun experience. I would definitely do it again. I don't think I want to be a contestant ever. I think it will be good for the state. Hopefully it'll bring some people to the state of Wisconsin. Maybe it changed a couple of people's minds on what the state's like. Maybe they think it's prettier. I think people still watch the show, and when they turned it off, they're like, oh yeah, all they eat is brats, cheese, and all they drink is beer. They could have done a better job, I think, showing more of what's offered here in Wisconsin and what grows here.
The really hard part for me in watching Top Chef is, you know, having everything narrowed down to a competition. I think the reason why I started my journey in food, and certainly the reason why I started my journey in television, was because when I was growing up in rural Wisconsin, I didn't have like an identity piece to look towards. There was nothing that was like representing me as a human being, be it through like the trials and tribulations of being in high school and like trying to find who I was and my voice in the world. I came to the realization that like we live collectively in this gorgeous, gorgeous place with some of the best farmers and food producers in the world. Watching Top Chef and seeing it all like sifted through the lens of competition. And as those of us in the food industry know, taste is subjective. Food is subjective. Art is subjective. Music is subjective. I really get stuck watching this production and watching the episodes because I am to support my friend Dan, but like also I hate that it's sifted through the lens of competition.
Top Chef is a competition show, though. It's a competition show that is a part of a capitalist system that most of our food world is also tied to. I think for, you know, Top Chef to be here in our home in Wisconsin, I hope it gets people to think about how food is ultimately personal, it's political, but it brings people together and it makes folks feel proud. And it's a gateway for people to be able to tell their story.
That was James Beard nominees and Top Chef judges Luke Somm and Greg Leon, who were joined by Chef and State Assembly Representative Francesca Hong. Their conversation was produced by Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez. Remember the Museum of Yesteryear in Milwaukee? One WUWM listener does, and she wanted to know what happened to it after making a donation. We'll learn about it and what happened to the collection in about 10 minutes. But first, we'll share some recommendations for Wisconsin State Parks to add to your summer adventures. That's next on Lake Effect on WUWM. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. From the Driftless region to the North Woods to the Door Peninsula, the Wisconsin State Park System encompasses 50 state parks. The DNR manages 1.2 million acres of recreation areas as a part of this system, including state forests, state trails, and over 6,000 campsites. With so much to explore, where do you even start? Well, for recommendations, freelance writer Allie Waters has plenty of suggestions to help you start planning. She wrote a guide to the Wisconsin State Park System for this month's Milwaukee Magazine, and she joins me now to share more. Allie, welcome to Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
So there are 50 Wisconsin state parks. So how many have you personally traveled to so far, and how did you get into the outdoors and all the activities that this can encompass?
I have always had a love for the state parks. I write about it a little bit in our package for Milwaukee Magazine. And as a child, my family, we all used to kind of pile into our minivans and we would go to different destinations around Wisconsin. And some of the ones that I really have a fond memory for are going to like Devil's Lake State Park. And we went to the Elroy Sparta Trail. We went to the Peninsula State Park, and that was kind of my first introduction to it, was doing these family camping trips, hiking around the town, playing with my cousins. I have now been to 20 state parks, and I would love to get to them all over the course of my lifetime, but it's hard because I keep returning to so many of my favorites, but I try to squeeze in a few new ones each year.
Well, I totally understand going back to the favorites, and your core memories are right along the line with my family camping trips. So whether people are exploring new parks or going back to old favorites, there truly is something for everyone, including those looking for different kinds of geography. So can you explain a bit of like the variety that people have access to within our state?
Yeah. So in the package, I broke this up in all sorts of different ways. We have the ones that are close to home. We have a section called The Bluffs Are Calling, which is all about our rocky geological state parks that have these interesting bluffs that you can climb to the top of and get these remarkable overlooks, often of the Mississippi River. We have parks that feature waterfalls that are absolutely stunning, and we kind of get into the different kinds of waterfalls we get, the really tall, skinny ones, the short, wide ones that you can walk right up to. We have parks that are along what we call the Fresh Coast. That's Lake Michigan. So we get to see these like massive sweeping views and these picturesque beaches. But then we also have a section, we call it Lakes That Are Still Pretty Great, which is all about our inland lakes. And then, of course, there's rivers, there's woodsy parks. And we also have a section all about the parks that are for the history books, the ones that feature a lot of our state heritage and where we came from before.
So many great things and, you know, lots to choose from with 50, right? But I want to start with what's close to home, which you categorize as just within 1 hour's drive of Milwaukee, which is great. And let's start with Harrington Beach. And I will say I went there a ton during COVID, even if it was just for a little day walk.
Well, that's a great thing is anyone who lives in the state of Wisconsin is probably pretty close to at least one state park that they can get to. More likely, they're close to a few. And so Harrington Beach is this great state park. It's on the sandy stretch of Lake Michigan, but it also has this really unique history to it. It preserves this old historic Wisconsin quarry town. So there's this big, like crystal clear quarry lake that you can walk around and you can peer into this 45-foot pit because the water is so clear and get a good look at it.
Yeah, and lots of good camping sites as well that are kind of more in the prairie land if you want it, or you can hear the lake even too. So Harrington's a great place to start. And if people want to take a trip just a bit further up 43 North, there's Kohler Andre State Park.
Kohler Andre is fantastic. It's actually my most recent state park, the newest one that I've seen. I visited it while I was writing this package. And what's so cool about it is it's actually two parks kind of for the price of one. The park combines Terry Andre and John Michael Kohler State Park. And the big draw to this park is that it has a cord walk, which is a lot like a boardwalk, except instead of walking over water, you're walking over sand. And you get to see these really delicate sand dunes and how beautiful they are. The last time I was there, I saw sandhill cranes, but a lot of people get really excited because they get to see deer prancing around the dunes.
Certainly a very picturesque park. Up next for within an hour of Milwaukee is Aztalan State Park.
Astolan is, it's a super important archaeological site for the state of Wisconsin. It preserves this ancient late woodland Native American village that was around roughly between the 11th and 13th centuries. So that is just super old. In 1919, they did this massive excavation of the area and uncovered a lot of the original settlement. So when you're there, you go into the visitor center and you can get this trail guide that will show you the history of this park, and you can walk around and do your own little self-guided tour, which is very cool.
I mean, there's so much history in a lot of the parks that you wrote about. It's something I hadn't considered and reasons to pick a new park, but I love that. And we're going to go outside of our little hour outside of Milwaukee path here, and we're going to go over a few of what are off the beaten path. And since COVID, camping obviously has gotten very popular, even into what we typically see as the off season. But you spoke with an expert to find some lesser known features, right?
Yeah, so I love our off the beaten path section, because what it does is it takes our three most popular state parks, Devil's Lake State Park, Peninsula State Park, and Governor Dodge State Park. Those are the parks that draw the most visitors. And we talked to an expert within the Wisconsin DNR, Sarah Bernaski, and I asked her, if you're going to these big parks and you want to kind of skirt the crowds, where should you go? And she gave us some great advice. So for Devil's Lake State Park, she talks about the fact that they just added a new trail there that is still a little lesser known that you can hit. At Peninsula State Park, she talks about the fact that they do these great theater shows within the park where you can go and catch a show. And these shows usually are about local connections. One of them is called The Fisherman's Daughter. And that one tells the story of two sisters in early Fish Creek who are dealing with what happens when the land that they live on gets turned into Peninsula State Park. And then Governor Dodge State Park, she offers up this great trail that actually leads you to a cave. And she makes a point to recommend that you should bring your flashlight so that you can see inside.
Yeah, a cave exploration sounds like a ton of fun and something different to do while you're hiking. And let's go to the Chain of Lakes area of Waupaca, Wisconsin, to Hartman Creek State Park next.
Yes, I remember the first time I went to Hartman Creek State Park. I had no idea what I was stepping into, and it has since become one of my absolute favorites. What it is it's part of the Chain of Lakes, which means these lakes, which are all spring-fed, are all interconnected. And so what you can do is you can rent a kayak, or you can bring your own, or a paddleboard, or a canoe, or whatever suits you. And you can basically do a little paddle trail through these different springs. And the real finale is if you end at Marl Lake. This lake is an unbelievably, like almost surreal, crystal clear blue lake that when you see it, you'll realize how spectacular it is. And so after you've worked up your sweat from paddling, you can jump in and take a dip, and you'll see tons of people just floating in their life preservers or swimming free and having a ton of fun taking a break from their boating.
I love the picture that you put there in my head. So we've been talking about a number of different state parks, but I want to give some love and a shout out to our first state park ever, and it's called Interstate Park. Can you share a bit more about the history there?
This was a really fun surprise to learn when I was writing about the state park feature, because the first thing that I thought to myself was, why do we have a state park system? Why is it so big? How did we get so much of this land protected? And one thing that I learned in the process is that Wisconsin was one of the very first states to even consider a setup like this. We started talking about the Wisconsin state park system really early on. In 1878, the Wisconsin legislature approved the protection of what was then called the state park, one of the first of its kind in the country. But it wasn't until 1900 that that really came to fruition. And the state park would eventually become Interstate State Park. And that also led to the founding of our Wisconsin State Park system, which is such an incredible undertaking. We have so much protected land in our state.
That is really amazing, and something we take for granted in our own backyard. And hopefully with this guide, it's a good starting point for people to get out, whether they're regular campers or just want to find something new in a day trip. But I want to end our conversation with one of your all-time favorite state parks, which is Rock Island. So why is this one of your tried and trues?
Rock Island State Park is just, it's like nothing you've ever done. So you go, everyone knows about Door County. People go to Peninsula State Park. But if you drive all the way to the tip of Door County, you have to go past that really famous curved road. You'll get to a dock and you'll have to take a car ferry over to Washington Island, which is another really beautiful island. If you go there, you should stop at the Lavender Fields. But you take your car, you go to another pier and you ditch your car and you get on a person ferry and you head to Rock Island State Park. Once you get to that island, there are no cars there. It's just people. You have to walk everywhere you go. You're likely going to camp there, but it's quiet like you've never heard, because when are you anywhere where there are no cars? And it's just super beautiful and spectacular. You can hike the whole park in a day, but it still feels remarkably big. But you get to experience the whole thing very well. It's a wonderful park. I highly recommend it.
I'll have to add that to my list. Well, Allie, thank you so much for joining me today to talk about some of the gems in our state park system.
All right. Thank you for having me, Audrey. It was great talking about them.
Allie Waters is a freelance writer for Milwaukee Magazine, and you can find her guide to the Wisconsin State Park System in this month's issue.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm WUWM's Eddie Morales. Bubbler Talk listener Susan Armour Seidman remembers visiting the Chudnow Museum of yesteryear in Milwaukee before it was closed. She even donated her father's World War II uniform to its collection. Since the museum closed, she's wanted to know,
what happened to the Museum of yesteryear that was in an old house sort of downtown, and what happened to its collection?
The Chudnow Museum was located at North 11th Street, across from the Milwaukee County Courthouse, for 8 years. Its doors closed permanently in 2021 due to the pandemic. The collection mainly features items from the early 1900s, which were arranged to recreate shops from the era, like an apothecary, barbershop, and shoe and grocery stores. Now, the museum's 150,000 artifacts are located at the Cedarburg History Museum. In Cedarburg, Daniel Chudnow explains the museum's origins.
The collection started out by my father, Avram Chudnow. He was called Abe. I think he was a friend of your father's.
I think he was, yeah. Actually.
Abe was born in 1913. Daniel explained that his grandfather emigrated from Ukraine to Milwaukee and was a peddler for many years.
It was his dream to open up a scrapyard, and he and his sons opened up the Chudnow Iron and Metal, which was on 54th and State. It's now closed, but it was a scrapyard for many years. I think my dad probably got the bug of collecting from him.
Abe displayed his collection in the basement of his Fox Point home. When the collection outgrew the space, he moved it to his Milwaukee office. And after Abe died in 2005, the Chudnows made it a museum. Back at Cedarburg, surrounded by grocery items like decades-old Wheaties boxes and 5-cent milk duds, museum director Joel Willems guides us to a World War II display that might contain the uniform donated by Bubbler Talk listener Seidman. But she can't recall if the jacket on display is the one she brought in nearly a decade ago. Seidman shares the significance of her father's military service.
My dad enlisted and was originally in the last regiment of the Horse Cavalry. Wow. People don't realize that there was still a Horse Cavalry at the beginning of World War II. And then he became a member of the Army Air Corps. He was a cartographer. He drew maps from airplanes over France, and he was also a navigator.
Near the display, a self-playing piano is equipped with a paper roll containing music for When Johnny Comes Marching Home. Museum director Willems says it's just one of the many attractions that visitors enjoy at the museum. Next, he leads us to a scale from 1910 that reads in painted blue letters, "Your correct weight, 1 cent. Before Willems worked in Cedarburg, he was the Chudnow Museum's curator in Milwaukee.
Mr. Chudnow told me himself that this came from the scrapyard. You know, somebody was going to throw and melt this down. Mm-hmm. And he had it repainted once by some of the people that helped him out with his collection. And we've never done anything different with it except for taking off the back so that we can access the money that just kind of gets rotated in there. One penny in, one penny out.
Willems approaches a crank phone hanging on the wall.
Eventually had three of them working that way. So it was a lot of fun for the kids to come in and listen. Oh, you're upstairs. I'm over down here. You know, they would make up entire fun conversations. Oh, can you order this? Can you get that for me?
He hopes to make the phone work again, just like it did at the museum in Milwaukee. For the adults that remember the Chudnow Museum, Willems explains the iconic display that guests want to see return.
I should mention the speakeasy that was through the barber shop. I still get many people come up to Cedarburg is like, where is that? I need to see that one. We'll probably bring it back at some time.
Standing among the thousands of items that Abe collected, Daniel says it was his father's dream to share the history of his collection with others. Eddie Morales, 89.7, WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Support for Bubble Talk comes from UW Credit Union. What have you always wanted to know about the Milwaukee area? Visit WUWM.com/BubblerTalk to submit your question.
Bubbler Talk wraps up Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers, Sam Woods, Excret Nunez, and Jimmy Gutierrez join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Robert Larry. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Mayon Silver, Taryn Powell, Lena Tran, and Eddie Morales from the WUWM news team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Join us again on Monday at noon for the latest episode of Chirp Chat, where Milwaukee residents share their spark birds, the ones that got them interested in birding. Thanks so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.